Time and time again, the principles which appear on the back cover of our bulletin every Sunday take me on a spiritual journey. They challenge me to dream. They also confront me with my shortcomings. They beg me to allow the heart of the universe to speak loudly and clearly that I might truly know what it means to honor the integrity of every person, to live justly and compassionately while searching for the truth. And over I struggle with the implications of the last principle, which, if my impulses serve me correctly, is the sine non qua for life itself. It is to see that interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And often I am awestruck by the magnitude of this covenant that we seek to embrace. And working with the search committee, it is interesting as we have put together this document that is called the Congregational Record. It's a long document, but it is amazing the number of times that these seven principles come to the fore. And it seems to me that the genius of those who dreamed these ideals and formulated this covenant was that they were aware of the great questions that we ask about life constantly, in one way or another. Who are we? What are we to be about? What is our purpose in life? To whom and for what are we to be responsible? Now, I hope we realize that these are perennial questions. Perhaps they are even eternal questions. The root of this is what in the Jewish tradition the creation stories in Genesis are really all about. In the heart, it is what you think about when you find yourself outside on a starry night, and if you can, for a little while, be childlike and lie on your back in the grass with your arms out and gaze up in wonder. You see shapes on that luminous moon, that heavenly pearl. The stars look so very far away, and indeed they are far away. And they tell stories of long ago. And if you listen very carefully, they will even tell you about when you were born. Where you see, they have been on a journey, and their journey is yours, it is mine. It is the story of this mystery that we have named. We call it life. Our relatively recent ancestors, going back a mere 3,000 years or so, wondered in awe as they looked up at the same sun, the same moon, the same stars. And they made up stories. And most of them were pretty good stories about how they imagined it all happened. And their guesses were often incredibly prescient. But because of the legacy of Copernicus and Galileo, and closer to our time, people like Hubble and his trusty telescope, we have new stories and we have up-to-date stories. Stories that make us appreciate, on the one hand, with some astonishment, I hope, the insights and the intuitions of our forebears. But they are also stories now that point us forward to explore our universe further, to understand new ways of living and loving that are in harmony with this vast mystery. But unfortunately, they are also stories that more and more these days serve to warn us. For what we know is that often we humans, for that is what we call this species of which we are a part, have gotten out of harmony with this universe, And in a most profound sense, we have gotten out of harmony with one another. And that's truly what we don't get sometimes, I think. We have separated ourselves from the story of the universe. We too often think that it's out there. And we, of course, are down here. The wonder and the mystery are out there someplace. There is no mystery down here. We have people who will tell us what it's all about. And with our trivial formulas, many have placed a supernatural being that we refer to as God up in the sky, though that is becoming more and more difficult these days. But it's a convenient ploy, somehow suggesting that ultimate accountability and responsibility are housed someplace else, other than in our own DNA. Many engage in that ritual that we have called prayer. It's a ritual that is important to many people, and I don't begrudge that for one moment. It provides comfort and solace in special ways, and we see this in spades with the people in the Midwest who have been ravaged this past week with tornadoes. But it is a ritual reinforcing the whole notion that the answers to life somehow are out there rather than right here. Some have tried to move inside of the ritual, and I'm one of those people. John Shelby Spong, who some of you have read, has tried to do that. And they are people who have stopped in their tracks, as it were, and have said, "Now wait a minute. Maybe I need to listen to what's already inside. Maybe I need to begin to get in touch with that delicate harmony that is at the root of my being, born of the stars so long ago, and is part and parcel of the universe itself." Alas, the mystery, you see, is out there, but the mystery is also right here. Now, hardly anyone really says all of that to herself or himself. I know that, and I made that up. But I wish they would. But one person who did was a devout Roman Catholic Jesuit priest and scientist named Teilhard de Chardin. And in poetic words he wrote, "If as a result of some interior resolution I were to lose in succession my faith in Christ, my faith in a personal God, and my faith in spirit, I feel that I should continue to believe invincibly in the universe." The universe, its value, its infallibility, and its goodness. That, when all is said and done, is the first and the last. The Alpha and the Omega. The first and the last, and the only thing in which I believe. It is by this faith that I live, and it is to this faith I feel at the moment of death, rising above all doubts, I shall surrender myself. Deschardin's classic work, The Phenomenon of Man, lays out a description of the evolving universe that we now know has been happening for 13.7 billion years. Our solar system began about 4.6 billion years ago, and first cells emerged about 4 billion years ago. It was only about 1 billion years ago that we get to the sex part. And really, only yesterday, about 2.6 million years ago, something resembling some of us emerged. I don't know which ones of us, but resembling us. We made some stone tools and we tried to hunt. Most of us were nudists. Where's Turner? Clothing, shelter, fire, hand axes to cut wood happened only 500,000 years ago. Now, there are many more pieces to all of this, obviously, and you can play, you can tinker a little bit with the dates. But do you sense with considerable awe the movement and the evolution that Desjardins and others observed? The breathtaking grandeur, the mystery of cosmic creativity, because things are changing all of the time. But nevertheless, how the variables of life itself were being held somehow in delicate balance all of that time. And when you read Desjardins, his description of all of this matches and passes any description that we have of the glory of God. What Desjardins imagined was that the creativity of the universe had the potential to be alive. Perhaps even to think, he used that as a metaphor. In the basic stuff of the universe was that urge to reach higher and higher and higher, to grow even into the consciousness of humankind. And there is a sense, he suggested, in which we become the mirror through which the universe sees itself and understands. Think of it. Becomes the mirror. One of my theological heroes was Paul Tillich, who used different terminology. He spoke of the new being to describe the place that Jesus took in what in theology is called the incarnation. And we Unitarians shouldn't be afraid of that word. It's a good piece of theology to get in touch with. Loosely defined, it captures the essential meaning of the birth stories in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, God becoming flesh and dwelling among us. It is what we mean when we use the term Emmanuel. It is a piece of theology, however, that Orthodoxy, pretty early on, turned on its head, making it mean almost the opposite of what I think was originally intended. And we've gotten it wrong. We've gotten it wrong for about 2,000 years. For what it is really all about is a turning away from polytheism and strict supernaturalism, a God who dwells in the sky and who is removed from humanity, to a force and a presence that is like us and with us and for us, yet points at one and the same time to eternal truths. It is, as Tillich suggested, understanding that the work of the universe is at the very ground of our being. That was another favorite term of his. And people used to joke, well, how can you pray to the ground of all being? Doesn't really make good sense. But the point is that it rests upon our shoulders, that it is our responsibility as a collective humanity to play our role that we have understood in times past to be this metaphor that we have called God. We are, said Tillich, to think the mind of God. We are God. Do we begin to get it? Dietrich Bonhoeffer said during the time of the Holocaust that we must learn to live as though there were no God, meaning some kind of supernatural figure who is going to intervene. And I think that what that means in the 21st century is that we need to get down to the very serious business of playing our role in dynamic ways. There will be no supernatural intervention. Our friend Rick Santorum is absolutely right, I think. It does matter what you believe. The The problem is that what Rick Santorum believes is destroying the world. And that's not a question. That's a declarative statement of fact. Brian Swim, who has produced the brilliant universe story upon which this sermon is really based, lays it right out on the line. And we need to hear it. We live on a different planet now, where not biology, hear this carefully, where not biology, but symbolic consciousness is the determining factor for evolution. Cultural selection has overwhelmed natural selection. That is, he says, the survival of the species of our entire ecosystem now depends primarily on human activities. We are faced with a challenge that no other humans even contemplated. How are we to make decisions that will benefit an entire planet for the next several millennia? You see, this is our God question. Do we get it? Are we going to wake up to the awesome responsibility? Will religious communities stop playing tiddlywinks and shape new metaphors and belief systems that can build, yes, build upon and reshape in imaginative ways the deep-rooted traditions out of which we come? But traditions which are paradigms that are obsolete and belong in a different century. Good intentions and grand plans have not carried the day. Our machines and the sheer numbers of people on our planet have become the major geological force. Ice caps are melting fast. Our oceans and rivers are themselves endangered species. The atmosphere and the soil are depleted and degraded. We have terminated what scientists call the Cenozoic era, which had its beginning 65 million years ago. What is called the Holocene period of the past 10,000 years is almost gone, and we have already entered what scientists call the Anthropocene era. Anthro, which as its name suggests, means that it is a time when we will be shaped in terms of our destiny by humans and not by nature. We humans have broken the merchandise. And when you break it, you buy it. When you break it, you buy it. And the question now is, how are we going to fix it? Drew Dellinger wrote that poem that we read and will continue to read in a few moments. But there was another poem that he wrote that was read to our United States Congress by a representative back in 2009. Didn't really get any place. But the poem starts out like this. It is 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was being plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing. Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? The thrust of this story is that there is great work required of us. The thrust of the seven principles is that there is great work required of us. The thrust of our journey is that we have a destiny. Surely we need to confront and challenge those things which seek to destroy life as we have known it. But how? We certainly know many practical ways, and we know some things that work. But as a scientist suggested the other night on the Bill Maher show, the real benefit of sending people into space or establishing an outpost on the moon, as Newt Gingrich has proposed, is not for the sake of feeding American hubris, but for the fact that what it does when we engage in such projects is that it unleashes the desire to dream, the will to search, the will to discover. Imagination and creativity and wonderment are then let loose, and we have a different set of paradigms to work with rather than fear and insecurity. Brian Swim says that we still have the stars. That's where it all started. Wonderment is born there, and that's where the story will take us. It is in the imagination. It is our connection with the universe that we will learn to look at the earth and our relationships with a brand new perspective. Swim says, our human destiny is to become the heart of the universe that embraces the whole earth community. We are just a small speck in that universe, but we are the beings with the capacity to feel comprehensive compassion in the midst of an ocean of intimacy. That is the direction of our becoming more fully human. We have our minds and our hands, and what that means is that we have the capacity to be creative and to build with that creativity with a consciousness that embraces that dynamic that began this process in the first place 13.7 billion years ago. We need new kinds of cities, healthier foods, but also new and compassionate ways to relate to one another. Ways that will make most of what we discussed today sound absolutely ridiculous. We will continue the sacred journey, learning new ways to love ourselves and others, and the planet upon which we abide and know as home. Join in the journey.